What are the special persons working on this?
These are just some numbers, okay? So if you give me J1 and J2, then there's a number that goes here. Well, it happens to be 1, 2, 3, J3. That's the only thing that can be. This is a sum on K, but if that's 1 and 2, then that has to be 3. Well, what number is that? Well, it's 1.
It's just a constant. It's just a number. Now, for a more general group, let's see. Have we done anywhere where this is... In all the groups we've looked at, you know, they've really just been ones or zeros or something. So, for example, in the Lorentz group, we had some rotations and we had some generators of boosts. And we found that the structure constants here, well, they were also epsilon I, J, K, and I think we got a K here. Is that right? Yeah, that's right. We got a K. It was plus or minus. I forget what the sign was. But even here, the structure constants. Okay, now, in general, for the Lorentz group, we have six generators. So, you know, A, B run, say, 1 to 6, and we divided them up into two sets of 3, because they divide nicely that way. But, you know, there are some numbers, A, B, C. You know, so what would this be? Well, if we let G, A, B, you know, J is first and K is second, G1, 2, and 3 are J's, and G4, 5, and 6 are K's, then what this relation says is that, what we're really getting here is, say, the commutator of J1 with K2 is going to be epsilon 1, 2, 3 times K3. So this is one of the commutation relations. The number that goes right here, well, it's 1, is C1, but then 2 corresponds to 5, actually, and 3 here is actually 6. So C1, 5, 6 is 1, is the constant number of 1. You see how I'm labeling those? So you can let these indices run over the whole set of generators if you like. So this is probably the most non-trivial example we've seen so far.
Are there always 3 indices? Or can it be connected?
On the structure constants always have 3. This is the most general relationship right there. Right? Every Lie algebra, you can write it like that. So the structure constant is for an n-dimensional group, you have it's like a rank 3 tensor in n dimensions. Right, you have something with 3 indices. Each one runs 1 through n. It's always anti-symmetric on the first pair. So in general, since A and B are anti-symmetric, there are n minus 1 over 2 possible choices for independent choices for A and B, because this is anti-symmetric. And then, there are n for this, so times n. So in general, you're going to have n squared, n minus 1 over 2 structure constants, independent real numbers that describe the structure of any given Lie algebra for an n-dimensional Lie group. Now, you know, you can almost always choose the basis, so those are mostly like plus or minus 1 or 1 over the square root of 2 or something, some simple things that... Then, when you start doing what are called Dinkin diagrams, you develop this graphic way of symbolizing exactly what the relationships of those different structure constants are, and that's how you classify groups, by this sort of pictorial technique of classification. Just uh, you It has to do with normalizing. You choose some of these that commute with the others, and you make just particular choices of the generators. So there's first some maximal number of generators that commute with the other one, say. I'm not sure exactly what the technique is, but it's that kind of thing. And so they can easily diagonalize those, and you know, then you do other tricks. You normalize things, and it leads to the Cartan classification. Actually, before Cartan, I think it was Wilhelm Killing did a classification of almost all of the Li groups. You know, there were a few things that Cartan tidied up, actually, although Cartan's work is considered to be the sort of the best reference on the subject. It was actually Killing and some others who did some of the really groundbreaking work, the first work in these classes.
Was it a paper or a book?
I think it might have been Killing's thesis. And his advisor was someone you've heard of too, and I can't remember who it was. But, I mean, these days, you know, you just go look it up on Wikipedia and you can find out all kinds of stuff like this. It's really fun.
It's up on your iPhone.
Yeah, I can look it up.
Instructional.
What's that?
Instructional. They might get the right answer.
Yeah.
And again, they've got some pretty hilarious ones.
Yeah, that's what they call him. Wilhelm Kapchok Killing. His name was actually Smith, but his cha-cha was so killing that...
No, the text cha-cha is like texting Google. They look it up.
Oh, cha-cha is a search engine? Oh,
You text 242-242, which is cha-cha on your keypad, and they'll tell you.
Okay.
Although you get some funny ones. I asked, what are the ratios of the sides of a 36-90 triangle? And they said 36-90 triangles are right triangles, and they come in all shapes and sizes.
Oh, that's great information there.
What are we teaching children in these schools?
There's actually an operator or somebody that actually responds.
Yeah, there's actually someone who looks it up online and types in the answer.
Do you have to pay for it or is it?
No, it's free. I thought that was pretty hilarious.
They're right triangles and they come in.
All shapes and sizes.
All shapes and sizes. Well, all sizes is correct.
But they come in different. They come in one shape. It's a triangle.
Well, I don't know. You know. All right. So you know, here's a 36-90, and you know, here's another 36-90. Are those the same shape or not? You know. I mean,
those are. But if you flip one, they're not.
You know, it's just a rotation in this case. But
shape.
Flip one. That's right. Yeah, no,
but see, when you're a kid, you can still flip it around and stick it through the hole, so you're good.
So, yeah, so are these the same shape or not? Well, you know, what group of transformations applies?
Well, we're thinking we're too hard about this.
So, you know, things are either the same or not, depending on what group of transformations you allow.
It's true.
So, you know, maybe they were right.
Well, not all shapes.
You know, they were assuming a different group.
They said they could come about all shapes, not two shapes.
Oh, all
shapes. I promise there's not a square that is a 36-90 triangle.
Well, in what geometry?
Okay.
Define your metric, you know. I bet you can define a metric where a triangle looks an awful lot like a square.
That's true, I guess. See, maybe like a
rippling surface.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Okay, I stand corrected. They can't come in all shapes and sizes. That's not what I was looking for.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to get four sizes, though. But
yeah, and I bet they weren't thinking that when they gave you the answer.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they had no idea.
Like, well,
I suppose, okay, so if we take a...
Oh, I started something now.
You know, if we take a sort of an angular geometry like this, where, you know, we happen to have a fold in our plane, and we define a metric on this plane such that the distance between any two points is one. Then, let's see. Now, I'm wondering if I can draw.
Do a cross and then come back and end up on the vertex.
Yeah, I want to go over here, but then it'll drop down.
The next one has to go straight to the vertex where it bends.
give you three.
Yeah. That's going to be tricky. That's going to be tricky. Yeah. So, you know, we've got to get back, don't we? You know, so we better connect those up that way.
Let's see. So, that's...
square-ish.
Well, it's quite a shape, anyway.
Not exactly a square.
But it is an equilateral triangle, nonetheless. So, there let's prove a theorem.
All right. About that?
No, not about that. Okay. So, theorem. I had hoped to sort of run through this sometime between Wednesday and today. I haven't had a minute. We'll see how we do. I think we can pull this off. So we want to let G be the you know, ba should be a word, you know, short for be a. Be a.
It's like you are, right? You are.
Yeah.
I just worked on the board as if I was texting.
The algebra of dimensions.
That's going to be a new shorthand pretty soon here.
And H, the subalgebra. Those dimensions M so the quotient of G by H is a manifold of dimension if n equals n, then, you know, this is something discrete, and I suppose we could call that manifold. We might want to assume m is less than n. If let's check that this holds in the case that we have a proof already for, namely, H is a normal subgroup of G. If H is a normal subgroup of G, then the quotient of G by H is a group. And let's see, I'm not sure we actually counted the elements of that group, but each coset of the group is one element of the quotient group. And since H is a dimension M and G is dimension N, there are, you know, the resulting group is said to be N minus M dimensional. I don't know. Is that clear? Do we need a picture? For example, we took a quotient of SO3 by SO2 by, you know, rotations around at the axis. Okay. We had a three-parameter group, but we're setting up equivalence classes where each equivalence class is a one-dimensional thing. So we're dividing the three-dimensional thing that is SO3 into equivalence classes, one-dimensional equivalence classes. How many equivalence classes does it take? Well, two dimensions worth. So, let's see, is there another... Yeah, that's the only example we've really worked out. Here's a simpler one. Suppose we have the four-dimensional translation group, and we take the quotient by the one-dimensional translation group. So we've got four coordinates, W, X, Y, Z, and we regard two points as being the same. We're setting up equivalence classes now if they have the same X coordinate. Or, no, I said it exactly backwards. If the two points are the same if their four-dimensional coordinate differs only in the x-coordinate.
So, yeah, there's an easy example where you can see the dimension. So we have a four-dimensional translation group. The parameters are, say, W, X, Y, and Z. We can, the four translations commute, so we can, you know, translate and increase any one of those by the amount of the translation. So we can move as much as we like in four orthogonal directions. You know, and let's let T1 be translations in X. So T4 takes something like W, X, Y, and Z to something like W plus W1, X plus X1, Y plus Y1, and Z plus Z1. So clearly the parameters of the transformation are, you know, the W1, W2, sorry, W1, X1, Y1, Z1. Okay, so I choose four real parameters. That tells me how much to translate each coordinate, and clearly I can sweep out all of R4 by doing appropriate translation. So the group manifold is R4. Now I want to take a one-parameter group, you know, so this is going to take this acts on the same space, but it only changes X. Like that. All right, so what's the quotient group? The quotient group, T4 over T1, all right, the coset, to find a coset, I take some element of the big space. Well, there's an element of the big space. That's what happens if I apply those four numbers to the origin. And now I apply every element of T1 to it. So it's the set of all things that looks like this for all X1. So, you know, it's basically the set of things W, any real number here, and Y, and Z. So this is what the equivalence classes look like. You know, we're in this four-dimensional space. We come to some point, and, you know, if that's the X direction, the equivalence class is going to be, you know, if this is, if this point is, let me just call it T, then T1, the coset of T, a la T1, is going to be that line. It's the set of all things we get by just shifting the X. And clearly there's one of those through every point of the space. So how many of those are there? Well, just count the three labels, right? There's for each W, 0, Y, Z, there's one coset. And by varying W, Y, and Z, we get all cosets. So the space of cosets is R3. All right. So simple example, I think, shows a little better how this works. And you can see why the dimension of this thing is, you know, plus the dimension of that denominator space gives you the dimension of the whole thing. You're setting up these equivalence classes that have the dimension of this space inside of something that has the dimension of that space. So how many of those can there be? Well, one for each point in some space that is dimension is the difference.
So the cosets
are
just like straight lines then?
Yeah, all the cosets are straight lines parallel to the x-axis.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and, you know, there's clearly one of those for each W, Y, Z. Do it in two or three dimensions if it's easier to draw.
Or just use time as your thing.
Yeah, Neil?
It'll be the same time. Let me ask if I'm getting this right. So we're taking the quotient of these two groups,
and what we're doing is we're taking P, and now P can move along, you know, this line in the one dimension.
Yeah, P1 will move P along that line.
Right, and then as we move P, the other three that are left are different at every point of P. Is that right?
No, the other three are the same.
No, they're the same. Let me do it in just two dimensions. So let's take T2 over T1. Okay, so T2, if you apply every element of T2 to the origin, you sweep out every point in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now T1, you know, let's let that be the x direction. So take any point in the plane and apply T1 to it, and you're going to sweep out a line like this, where y is constant.
Mm-hmm.
So T1 is going to sweep out a y equals constant line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, pick another point in the plane. Apply T1 to it. So we've got another y equals constant line. Okay, how many different ways can we do that?
As many y as you have.
One for each y.
Yes.
One for each y, exactly. So this space is R1, and in fact, the elements of this space can be labeled by y. We get exactly one coset for each y. So it's that manifold that we're after constructing here.
I get it. So we're putting P in different parts of the three dimensional space that's left.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
I get that.
Right. So there's three dimensions worth of choices for P that give us different cosets.
Okay. So we're just taking one dimension and making it only available at one point, at each point.
One
dimension.
Yeah, this translation, the thing you're dividing by, you're setting up equivalence classes and calling that one point.
Right.
So now you want to know how many points you've got. So you've classed, you know, one copy of R is a single point, so you've reduced the whole thing by one dimension. Okay. Good. All right. Let's see. Why do you want to shoot that? Because I want to erase it so I have room for the term.
Just focus on the examples here and we'll back up.
So when you collapse it all into one point and you've managed to reduce it by one dimension, is that point at every point?
Yeah.
That collapsed point is crossed on every point of our higher dimensional space?
That point is crossed. Let's see, what do we mean crossed?
Well, similar to talking about something like SU3 at every point on a different dimension.
There's one of these lines through every point of the plane.
Right.
That line creates the one dimensional space.
So in the two dimensional example, let's see here. In the two-dimensional example, so for each y, we have one of these cosets now.
Okay.
So these are the cosets. And then this, taking this quotient, you know, T2 mod T1, okay, so this whole space is T2, and, you know, one of these cosets looks like T1. All right, what this maps to is each of these cosets act like one space. So we get one point for each coset. All right, that's our quotient space. So this is the manifold we're constructing by this theorem. Did I answer your question there?
Well,
I'm not sure I was quite getting your...
We still have the original space, T2.
Yeah, it's still there.
It's still there.
So somewhere inside each of these points, we know we've got a T1.
Okay.
Those are the fibers in our fiber bundle.
Okay, yeah.
Right, so we have a space here that will prove as a manifold, but in addition, we know that each point of that has associated with it a copy of a group.
Or a space. Okay.
Yeah, it'll be a subgroup in our cases. Yeah, you can take quotients of things besides groups, but this is what we'll be looking at. Okay, does that help? Yeah. Okay. Now, So it's clear how the dimensions work. So in the case where H is a normal subgroup, we prove that this object is a Lie group. It's another Lie group. And a Lie group is a manifold, and its dimension is going to be n minus m. So in the case of a normal subgroup, we've already shown the theorem. We didn't specialize what we did to Lie groups, but the group you get is going to be labeled by real parameters, so it will in fact be a Lie group. That might be a good exercise even to. So if you have a Lie group and a normal Lie subgroup, the quotient is another group. Prove that that group's the Lie group. And I'll write it down for you. So I should say. I might as well give you as many exercises as I want to somebody but Nathan doesn't. Let's see. For H normal, G over H is a group. A group. Group. Prove that G and H Lie groups and H normal implies G mod H is a Lie group. Assume the dimension of H is less than the dimension of G. Yeah, I suspect it'll be obvious. Or, you know, if you want the shortcut to the theorem, combine our theorem about normal subgroups with the theorem we're about to prove, and it's a consequence. You're done.
Please accept that. My theorem is your theorem that.
We'll see.
Try to solve it.
Okay. So, I started talking about our strategy here before. You know, here's a picture of our group manifold G. And we pick some point in it, little g, and we trace out coset of coset GH in G. So, GH is the set of all G prime in G, such that G prime is G times H for some H in the subgroup. You can say it different ways, but yeah, so basically you take your initial point G and you multiply it on the right by every possible H and it sweeps out some subspace. Now, the trick to showing that this is a manifold is to choose the right coordinates. And we can do that by using the coordinates in H. Since it's a manifold, Well, let's consider first some open set. Some open set in G. And a chart, since it's a manifold, there's some chart that takes that to, some open set in Rn.
Where, have I got that? Yeah, dimension is n. So, phi is the bijection. It takes us back and forth between open sets here and open sets there, as long as we choose them small enough so that they're not wrapping around some torus or, you know, some... They should be simply connected little things. We can make them as small as we want, because we can have as many of them as we like. Now, what I would like to do is choose coordinates over here so that we get coset, so that moving up and down the coset or let's see, how should I say that? Motion along GH only changes Y. So what I want are, I want some coordinates, let's call them Z, of the form X, Y, where, this is some X1, X2, up to, what's the dimension? K, X with K, and then Y1, Y2, up to Y to M. M plus K is N. So I want the last M coordinates of my position vectors here to only parameterize motion along H. Now, through each point of this open set, through any point of this open set, there is some coset of H. So we know what it means to move along H in this set. Since all of G is threaded by copies of H, all of this open set is threaded by copies of H, and so it's naturally divided into two directions. There's along H, and there are other directions. So basically, I can do this by choosing the last M coordinates first, and then letting the first K be any independent coordinates from those. Since they have to span all of some open interval in Rn, we know what it means to choose independent coordinates. They have to span Rn, so changing any of these will change which fiber you're on. Okay, that's the key point. Changing any of the x's moves you to a different fiber.
Move you to y.
Exactly, yeah. Changing y moves you along this way. You know, if I've got some point here and I want some point up there, if this is some g1, I can get there by multiplying by some h. And that H, remember, is labeled by M coordinates. And I can use those coordinates to label all the points, you know, along any given coset. All right. Now we're we may be home free here, because these K things, right, we said it, and you all nodded. If I change any of the x's, I've moved to a different coset.
we've got labels for the cosets. Those are our coordinates for the quotient space. Alright, so all we have to do is hold the y fixed and vary the x's. So we've got the set of z equal to x1 through xk, and some fixed vector y. As we vary those x's, we're sweeping across some subspace here, such that every point in that subspace represents a different coset. And these are basically what I want the open set to look like on the quotient space. So the charts on the quotient space are going to be set like that. All right, they're mapped like this. So let's try a chart.
Before we move on, I have a question.
Yes.
So are we assuming we can always take sets small enough that that our H is linear somewhat in that, so that you can label those?
Oh, it doesn't have to be linear by any stretch, but in fact we can do that.
But what I guess I was asking is, does it rely on that? Because in order for the dimensions to stay that way, then if you moved in that dimension, would you be...
Right. What we're relying on is that this set is not so big that, you know, we have any, you know, non-shrinkable loops in H.
Oh, but
right.
Than that. Okay.
But but it can be any coordinate at all. I mean, you know, yeah, suppose it's linear. Now take, you know, the exponential of that, and that's still a one-to-one onto map on that region. So...
Right, but we have to do the map, those last coordinates
are... E to the Y1, E to the Y2, and so on, would work just as well.
Right.
You know, we don't want the range to be large, because then we're in danger of sort of looping around some non-shrinkable thing. I mean, it's possible H is S1, you know. The circle group. Well, you don't want to go clear around the circle, or it's not an open neighborhood, maybe. You know, or you get it's not a proper chart. It's not a proper chart if you do that.
Okay. I think I'm seeing it now.
Okay.
I'm thinking
about
that example.
The circle, yeah, right. Yeah. Too big of an open set. So let's see if we have a chart. So we have O is some subset of G. We have a chart phi that takes O into Rn, and that's some collection. And here we make a choice. X1 through, so it's a set of n tuples, x1 through xk, and some y1 through ym. And from that, let's see, what I want to do is freeze all the y's. Phi at y naught is, you know, map O to a set of things x1 through xk and some fixed y naught in the set. And it does not actually matter which y naught we choose, because, you know, we can change y naught by just shifting up and down here, or
what we can do is, for any chart like this, I can find another chart just by doing a diffeomorphism, a coordinate change, in Rn to a new chart where that's actually zero. So that phi y naught, just translate this set by a constant vector. I can translate that to the zero vector. So since this is a differentiable transformation, infinitely differentiable, you're just translating everything by a constant, this is just as good a chart as that one was. And so now, and clearly this is an element of RK. These are invertible on the space of cosets. If I ask what coset, so if I fix x1 through xk and say what coset did that come from, I can take any y at all. I take the inverse of phi. To get the inverse, phi inverse of any point x1 xk and any y gives the same coset. And this phi sub y naught, or we might call that one phi of zero, or that mapping are one-to-one onto mapping from cosets to elements of RK. So we have a set of charts. What else do we need to have a manifold?
You could define a non-Hausdorff manifold.
Oh, man.
You raised a sticky issue.
If we've quotient it by a compact set, it's not
hard to prove that it's Hausdorff.
If we've quotient it by something open, then it may come to case-by-case proofs, but I don't know. We haven't had to assume so far that this is open. We did prove last time that the whole rod through this set is an open set in G.
Right, yes.
And that may be enough to prove that it's Hausdorff. Because that means that I can find a neighborhood of any point on a given coset lying in that rod. That rod gives me a beautiful open set around any given coset. I can shrink it as small as I like. So take two cosets, take a small rod around each one. They don't intersect because they don't have any. If they did, they wouldn't be distinct cosets. So I think we could easily construct a proof that it really ought to be Hausdorff all the time. We should try that and publish it. The mathematicians don't seem to know that, but they may not be thinking just of Lie groups. There's some sneaky counterexample that we're not thinking of. But, we did get that rod to be open, so.
Right. And we're probably okay. It's hard to see how it's going to go wrong.
If you try the simple-minded approach and say, okay, here's a coset, I can find sets around those that don't intersect, and now I'm going to move up some open set. Well, how do I know those two aren't getting closer and closer and closer and approaching some limit point up here? And just the limit point's not in there, so those sets are shrinking to zero. Well, if that's your construction of the proof of Hausdorff property, and you want to take the union of these, you're going to be in trouble because, it still works.
but it's harder to see that it works. If you've got a finite open cover of some compact set, you know, that limit can't go to zero.
Right.
You can pick the smallest radius open set around each coset, take that as the diameter of your tube, and you're done. With the open set, you know, you've got to ask the question, sorry about the digression here, but, you know, you have, say you're looking at x squared and minus x squared, right? So say your two cosets are approaching each other, and, you know, you don't have the point zero, you don't have the origin in your set. Can you come up with an open set that covers each of those? Can you come up with disjoint open sets that cover those two curves? You see how to do it? The upper half plane and the lower half plane do it. That's trivial. I thought of that when swimming the other day. Oh, upper half plane, lower half plane, done. I think the outdoor things are red herring. I think it's going to always be outdoor. But I haven't really written down a really careful proof, but it's probably fine. And I think for the groups that we're considering, just looking at dilatations, outdoors. Because the problem is exactly like this. With dilatations, you get exactly this issue, but duh. You know, all you have to do is you take a series of open sets here, well, you shrink the size of them fast enough, they're always dodging that other curve, and take the union as a countable set of open sets, that's fine, that's still open, and those don't intersect. So, you know, there are two ways to do that. You know, like the plane, or just unions of disks, and you just specify how fast you have to shrink those disks to keep them from skidding. So you can find open sets. But you guys know what the Hausdorff property is?
No,
I'm sorry. Okay. Take the points of your topological set. The space is Hausdorff. If for any two points in your space you pick, you can find disjoint open sets, one containing each point, but the two open sets don't intersect. There are spaces where that's not. Sierpinski space doesn't have that property. It's not Hausdorff, right? That very most trivial topology, I think we wrote down a month or two ago.
So it's kind of like saying that, well, when you do the conversion stuff, every neighborhood is not you can find a neighborhood that does not contain that point.
Yeah, it's possible to find that, like, you know, if you take the real line and half line, and you define the topology to be open sets, you know, open sets here and open sets here plus that set up there, then any open set containing that point, is not disjoint from something containing the point directly below it. This point is not in the set. But any neighborhood of this point contains points from that top. Let's see. Am I saying this right?
I think you want to have.
Maybe I do want that point in there.
I think the way I've seen it was that, like, it's like a half. It's like those are lines at a certain point. But you don't have the rest of that line on the bottom. So if you try to separate by open points or with open set at any point, the closer you get to that one point, you'll be getting to another point on the bottom or so.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to do here. If you have any open set containing this, it's going to contain some pieces of that up there.
Right.
So I can pick two distinct points in the set, but there's no open set around this one that doesn't also contain that one.
Right.
So this is not how it's fit. Yeah, you've got the right example in mind. Yeah. So, you know, you can cook up examples, and this is one of many separation axioms. It allows you to, separate points. Not relevant. Let's get back to our theorem. Okay. The thing we need to prove to have a manifold is that if we have two neighborhoods of a given point, if we have two two open sets of cosets that intersect, then we have two charts, from each of those open sets. On the intersection, we want them to be proper coordinate transformations of one another. We want them to be, let me write it precisely. What we need is for there to be, how smooth do we want these? Let's say a smooth mapping between the two coordinate systems. So now, we've got a bunch of fibers here. We have open sets. We have our chart five of zero here, phi prime, sub zero here, and this goes to RK, some open set in RK. This goes to some other open set in RK. And we're concerned about this overlap region. So on, let's call this O1 and O2. On the intersection, O1 intersection O2, require, first we act, so we take a point here, we act with phi naught inverse, so this acts on points in RK, and then we take the result of that and we act on that with phi prime, and so this brings us up to that intersection region, then phi naught prime takes us down into RK, so what we have is phi naught prime intersection phi naught inverse takes us from RK to RK. Alright, that's a real value function of real variables. And we can ask whether that is to be smooth. Let's take it to be C infinity, we can take it to be continuous or C2 or differentiable as many times as we like. Let's just say it's differentiable as many times as we like. Choose a smooth, set a smooth charge. So this is really where the differentiable structure of the manifold comes in relating nearby coordinate patches to one another. So we need to look at the intersection of two charts. And here's the way I want to do it. I want to use the manifold structure of G. So this map will be as smooth as G is. So if G is a C infinite manifold, these will be C infinite maps. If G is a continuous manifold, which is all you really have to have for a Lie group, it'll be a continuous manifold. The manifolds that we've looked at are all C infinity. We can take any charts that are all on there, and they'll be very nice. But whatever G has, we'll get here for the degree of smoothness of the chart. So my strategy is going to be to thicken out these two open sets to be open sets in G. Well, we proved last time that we can do that because if we take the cross product of, or if we map these, let's see, what did we do? We took the we took an open set, and we took the union of the cosets. We showed that the union over, let's see, what do we call it? We call it the cosets of O in H. That's the union over all G in O of the coset GH is open in G. So O1 and O2H are open in G. Their intersection is just the coset of the intersection of the two sets we started with. Right? So we can look at the rod over that one, we can look at the rod over this one, and the intersection of those rods is the rod over the intersection. And that's the intersection of two, that intersection is the intersection of these rods, and is therefore open. Now, let's see, what do we want to say about the coordinates on these? I guess this is the conclusion we need, that these two are open, their intersection is just the right thing, but because they're open in G, the charts in G satisfy the manifold condition, right? So, let's see. We need a caveat. Okay, they're open in G, but we're not guaranteed to have a chart on the whole of the rod, right? We can cover G by open sets such that there's a chart from each of those open sets Rn, but we're not guaranteed that there is such a chart on the entirety of a rod.
I think that's where I was hitting with the other things that we didn't have that.
Yeah. So and your suggested solution is just right. We want to shrink it. We want to thicken this just a little bit. That's going to give us a set. The other thing we have to do is make sure that those intersect in some open set. Now these sets came from some open sets in G. The trick is we may have to. So here's another problem. All right, so we can thicken them once we get them to be open sets in G, whose intersection is a thickening of the intersection here. We're done. We've got it. I'll say that again.
One too small enough?
Yeah, well, okay, here's one problem that can happen. Okay. Right, so here's G. So there's G. And we've got some coset, some open set containing that coset, labeling some bunch of cosets here. Suppose we got that coset. I'm sorry. Suppose we got some chart from that open set in G, and what we did is we projected down so it to y equals zero, and we're just looking at the x coordinates that take us between cosets, and that gives us so this thing is our chart on the coset space. Now we've got an intersecting one, so we've got a bunch more cosets over here, and we've got some open set in G that we've projected to another open set that we projected to y equals zero. The problem is that those two open subsets of G don't actually intersect at all, because they came from different parts of
different values of y. So the thing we need to do is extend the chart on the quotient space to an open set in G in such a way that the intersection still stays the same.
So can we just choose a chart such that?
Yeah, I think we can do that. So if we consider that, so let you know, phi, let's see, our phi zero, right? That's going to be the set of some x1 through xk and 0. You know, elements of some open set in k, in Rk. So O sub k is some set open in Rk. Okay, so that's our chart. If we take phi zero inverse of that, is that's not open in G. It's too small. It's a k-dimensional subset. It's flat. What I want to do is thicken it up here and consider instead phi inverse, so phi is a chart on G of the points x1 through xk and vectors epsilon and y such that x1 through xk lie in ok, and epsilon lies in some neighborhood of some open set around O in the y space. In where is that? R M. I'm going to choose that one small. Okay, that's why I called it epsilon. So the idea is, where can I just kick this? Let's move to the other end. So here's the picture I want. So here we are in Rn, and this is y, and you know, element of R. M. And this is x, element of Rk. So a highly condensed version of n dimensions. So what we've got is some set. You know, this open set is okay. That's open in Rk. And that's our neighborhood. You know, OK is what phi 0 does to our, say, our open set O subset of G, open set of G. So we've got some O back here in G. We act on it with our coset chart, and we get some open set in Rk.
Why is it not open if you go backwards?
Because it's just a line across the coset, right? It has no thickness in G, like a measure zero. If you think of a metric topology, for example, you want like an open ball. This would be like a pancake. You see?
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, going through it this way is just see one point and you're out. So, but what I want to do is choose, you know, the set from sort of minus epsilon to plus epsilon subset of Rm. Let's see. I want this to be a subset of Rm. And so I want to choose something that in this diagram looks like a little rectangle. So I thicken it in the y direction.
Just not to get that.
So I include all y's. Let me. So this is the set of y. such that what do we want? We want the norm of y less than some epsilon, basically, and that's some subset of Rm.
Yeah.
So just some neighborhood, a small ball around the identity, around the origin, is what we're after. That's exactly what I said. Okay, so an epsilon ball around the origin, and include those at each point. So what I want is to let some set O, or what should I call it? Let's call this U. Let U equal the set of all X, Y, such that X is an element of OK, and the norm of y is less than some epsilon. Right? And that set is going to be that set is going to be open in Rn. Therefore, phi inverse, right? If phi is a chart on all of G, one of our original charts from G, phi inverse of U is open in G. So a chart inverse of an open set in R is going to take us back to an open set in G. We can take epsilon as small as we like, so we're not in danger of looping around our subset H. And this will give us this gives us some open set that looks like a little flat, a disk. It looks like a little disk.
Small copy.
Yeah.
And the only reason we... Okay.
So we get this hockey puck that's open in G.
We have to choose that from a small enough set.
We don't want to wrap any loops this way.
Right.
It doesn't have to be. It probably doesn't have to be small. It might be all of H and be fine. But we can choose it as small as we need to. We know we've got a linear neighborhood here. From the Lie group, we can expand in a linear neighborhood. So we could go to order one in epsilon, and be guaranteed we've got some open set, just continuity in G. But depending on the group, you can make it as big as you like. As long as it's open in that direction, you're going to end up with some open neighborhood in G. Then what you want to do is thicken this one the same way, and now you've got two open sets in G.
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be as simple just to require that the same chart you used up there is still applying down here, if that makes sense.
The same chart
you're using this chart that is this chart up here shifted down here. We only know that works for this projection. Do we know that it works for the whole line? Does that make sense?
What we need is the existence of some open neighborhood,
right,
in G on which there's a chart, and some open neighborhood containing this open set that on which there's a chart. Now, if we had trouble finding that, then we're not going to have trouble finding that because we got all of this from charts to begin with. See, the thing is, right? We got this pancake chart initially from some open set in G. So that pancake is the projection of some open set. Well, I can also translate that open set down to this position.
Okay.
And I can fit some epsilon inside it for sure.
Okay. Make it bigger than that epsilon.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. So the original open set that gave rise to this, you know, still is there somewhere. There's an identical open set that lies right over top of this set and
okay.
contains it. Now I thicken it. Or just use that open set. So this would be another route to the proof would be to just take some open sets gave those original neighborhoods on the coset space. I could just translate those until they intersect, say, maximally, until their intersection contain the intersection I was interested in. There's some translation in why that does that, and now I've got the condition I need there because of the overlap of those two regions. Right, so that's another way to do it. That works too. The thickening here is a little tighter, maybe. But in any case, let's see. Where do we want to take the plan? This is now open in G. So to finish the argument, let me just do it here where I had it before. So the argument is basically not to worry about those up there or that down here, but to say that phi inverse of U1 intersection phi inverse of U2 that's in the intersection. So I could take, say, five, suppose, what are these two called? Phi and phi.
Yeah.
But I need different names for these. Let me call it phi 2, 0 and phi 1, 0. So 2, 0, 1, 0. 2, 0, 1, 0. Okay, that's better. So if I take phi 1 of phi inverse of U1 intersection phi inverse of U2. That's going to take this thickened intersection region and map it right to my coordinate system x1 through xk in Rk. And so, let's see, what have we got? Where are our charts?
Isn't that pretty much all you have to do?
Yeah, we know that in G. Yeah, we're pretty much there. I'm just trying to say it. But in G, we've got these sets. We've got these maps phi. So I've got some phi that takes U1 into Rn, some phi 1 and phi 2, let's call them, that takes U2 into Rn. And we know that phi 2 composed with phi 1 inverse is C infinity or whatever we have on our original manifold. And now we've got it because phi 1, 0 and phi 2, 0
we just hold y constant. There's y. So y goes to the zero vector. And so, right, we've got a real valued smooth function from Rn to Rn. We hold m of the coordinates constant. Now we've got a smooth function from Rk to Rk. Right? We're just holding some of the variables constant. The others still vary smoothly. And so we've got a smooth map from Rk to Rk. And that's what we needed back here to have our C infinity manifold for the coset. And that does it. We've got a manifold.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a funny kind of proof, because, you know, you can say it in 5 minutes, or you can say it in 5 weeks, depending on, you know, exactly the amount of detail you want to, you know, put into each of these statements. But it's easy to see what's going on, right?
The gist of the proof is to construct charge where we adapt the coordinates to the coset, so that m of the coordinates only move you up and down the coset. The remaining k coordinates distinguish distinct cosets. And so that's what gives us our charge. All the other properties we need for the manifold structure are inherited from the manifold structure of G. So we get it. And that was the 1 minute version. Okay. So these are the manifolds. This is where we live, folks. You know, we live on one of these manifolds. So, Daniel, have a good weekend.
Happy Friday the 13th.
And what is it? President's Day Monday. And we meet Tuesday.
And Valentine's Day tomorrow.
A busy weekend. Man, Friday the 13th, Valentine's Day, what does that mean?
Hang tight
till tomorrow.
That doesn't bode well.
Yeah, that means different things to different people.
If you find anything today for tomorrow, you're hosed.
Yeah, you should have gotten it already. All right.
Don't plan anything too gruesome for tomorrow.
Unless you planned it yesterday.
Unless, yeah.
Then you're okay.
I'm totally confused now.
Good. Questions? How are we doing? You got it?
I'm going to have to play around with a little bit before I fully accept everything, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What'd you say, Jeff?
I think there's a lot there.
Well,
conceptually, not that bad.
Yeah, right. Yes, exactly.
There's a lot of
regularization. How do you say it, like, in set notation and mappings and stuff? And, you know, that's what gets grisly. But, you know, doing it is what shows you where you're making stupid mistakes. Yeah, you know, as I think about it now, it strikes me that each of our charts over here on the coset came from some open set in G. So if we were to take two open sets of these and map them back to the open sets in G they came from, okay, so what if they don't intersect? Use multiplication, you know, right, multiplication by elements of H to translate them back to the right position so they do intersect. There has to be some translation where their intersection contains the intersection of these charts, and then do the property from G. Now that might be a little cleaner than trying to stick in the thing.
Yeah.
It's surely okay to stick in them, but it's not as clean proof-wise. You have to prove some other stuff to really see that second thing is open. Whereas, you know, since you know they came from some open sets to begin with, you might as well use those open sets. It's just simpler. So, another exercise, go home and prove it that way.
Well, there's another theorem that every point is in a chart, pretty much, in the manifold.
Oh, every point has to be in a chart, yeah. So yeah, that's part of the definition.
So just choose charts along that line and set up.
Well,
choose only charts. So choose, hold something fixed and choose charts such that it can take that
you're not guaranteed, you know, if you pick 2 points, you're not guaranteed that there's a chart that contains both.
Right. So pick your entire space first, and then pick charts that line up with things.
Which space?
The space that you choose what you're holding fixed. Pick charts that are all in that space you're holding fixed.
What am I holding fixed?
You go to magic from one place, choose what you're holding fixed, find another chart that contains that. I guess you have to construct it one piece at a time.
Wait, so I want the free image of this back here, or
okay, yeah, exactly. So get that.
That just lies in here.
Now
is that the set you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Take that set. Now come back into the manifold and find the next chart that contains part of that, because it has to be.
But how do I know there's an open set that contains that whole thing?
Don't they have to be overlapping?
Oh, it overlaps with some other set. So over here, you know, I've got, in Gmod H, right? You know, that's some manifold. So over here, I've got two open sets that overlap. I've got three images of those back here, and they look like little pancakes there.
Right.
So they're not open in G.
Right.
How do I know I've got open sets containing them?
Oh my God.
Right. In fact, I do, because by my construction, I got these from some open sets over here. But I don't know that those open sets intersect. But I know that somewhere the cosets around those do intersect. And that's what I want to use. So I want to translate those until they do intersect and use that intersection in G.
Okay.
You're out of town. Where
are you off to?
On a farming safari.
I had a feeling it might be that.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Anywhere.
Nice. Have fun.
Nice.
Come back in one piece.
We skied off of a mountain last night.